Welcome back to the Anaheim Calling Podcast. It's been a little while. We're back fresh from the bye week. Had a little bit of a vacation here, but we're back and there's a lot of news to get to. Joined today by Anaheim Calling Associate Editor CJ Woodling, Anaheim Calling Staff Writer Jake Rudolph. Guys, did you enjoy your vacation? Did you go to the Caribbean like some of the Ducks players did?
Definitely. No, I did not.
Not.
Oh, man, I went to Europe. Screw that Caribbean crap.
Yeah, I watch football, so there you go.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's a close second to Europe, I'd say.
Yeah, right. Sure. But we have a lot to get to. We actually didn't do a show for Saturday's game against the Kings, which is going to be sort of the tip of the iceberg for a lot of the conversation we're going to have tonight. Decided to extend my bye week a little bit and didn't really do a pod for the Kings game, but fear not, we will get to it. There was also a matinee affair today between the Anaheim Ducks and the Colorado Avalanche. The Ducks losing this one 3-1. Kind of a big 2 points here that they dropped. But Jake, you can fill us in here on the last couple games. Give us the rundown.
Yeah, so I'm going to start here just kind of running down the Kings game. And just as a quick disclaimer, we are going to leave out the Cogliano stuff. We're going to get to all that later for you guys. And
kind of what happened? I didn't hear
about it. Oh, yeah. You haven't seen all the hubbub? So this was actually a really fun game. This Ducks Kings game really kind of was it was the perfect rivalry game between the two. You had the game start and within, was it 4 or 5 minutes, there were three fights that all started in a row. Kind of was a good throwback game and kind of good back and forth. And in the first period, Andrei Kasha comes up the wing, takes a little shot, beats Quick five hole. Not the best, work by Quick there, but I mean, you take it. And then on the power play didn't get a whole lot going late in the period. Second unit comes out, and Kessler kind of makes a little bit happen out of nothing. Pulls the puck off the board and just snipes the top corner. Once again, it's kind of one of those shots that you see, and it's almost like you wonder, like, I wonder if Quick probably should have had that. But like the Kasha goal, you'll take it. And then we move through the second period and move on to the third period because there was no scoring in the second. And in the third period, Andrei Kasha early on in the period makes it 3-0 for the Ducks off a pretty nice forecheck by Nick Ritchie. He gets in once again on a very weird moment by Jonathan Quick, I guess, story of this game. And gets the puck off of Quick, trying to clear it around the boards. Feeds it to Kasha, who has basically an empty net to pot it into. And then the Kings kind of come back and score two goals to make it tight, but the Ducks find a way to hold on, and Perry ices the game with the fourth goal on the empty net. And so that's kind of the story of that game, and that was a really big win for the team. It was a big swing game. They were 6 points back of the Kings, and that brought them to 4 points back. And so moving into today's game against the Avalanche, as Felix will probably say, my Avalanche.
Even though yes, I don't go. You know, I actually forgot. I'm rusty. It's been a while here. But yes, your Avalanche. But hey, you should own this corner because what are they on? Let's see here.
They're on a seven game
winning streak.
They're on a 7-game streak. They're on a 7-game bender. They are. Yeah. Going so through the quad to the gymnasium. So in this game, in the first period, Matt Nieto comes out after a really strong shift for the team for the Avalanche, and pots just kind of a really weird broken play. Lindholm breaks his stick and makes it 1-0 for the Avs. And then in the second period, there was a really nice shift by the Ducks' second line there with Kessler, Brown, and Silverberg, with Brown filling in for Cogliano in this game. And Kessler has a really great chance backhand, and just Bernier makes a save on it. Throws his stick out, makes the save. It's just kind of one of those where it's better to be lucky than be good in those situations. And then the puck turns over, comes the other way. Nathan MacKinnon does Nathan MacKinnon things this season and pots it. And
he's amazing, by the way.
He's so good. And then Wagner pots kind of a dirty goal to bring it within one. And then late in the period on the power play, the Avalanche go on to score and make it 3-1. It was kind of an interesting play. Colin Wilson found some soft area right in the slot and made it. Found the space in the slot and kind of potted the goal. The Ducks forwards and Getzlaf and Kessler were really kind of on the ends of their sticks, weren't really kind of pushing forward to kind of get in that soft zone and get a stick on him. Kind of story of this game for me is just kind of that chance by Kessler not going and then turning over, coming the other way. That's a two-goal swing right there. The Ducks score there. They make it 1-1 instead of it going and becoming 2-0 at that point. And then the Ducks also having penalty kill trouble, or not penalty kill troubles, but penalty troubles in general. They had 6 penalties on the day, and one of them went in. You add that into the fact of that kind of missed chance by Kessler going the other way. That's kind of the story of this game. And so...
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, people... You seem, Jake, to be a little bit more optimistic on kind of the outcome of this game, or
yeah.
I guess the way the Ducks had played. CJ, I know that you caught some of the game. Any sort of general impressions?
You know, Jake made a good point, I think, on Twitter earlier to somebody responding to the Anaheim Calling Twitter account, where it was one of those things where Ducks actually played all right. You know, they weren't bad by any means. They were actually pretty good, outshot the Avs. And I think he said that's a game, you know, the Ducks win maybe 6 or 7 out of 10 times. Just ran into a really hot goalie. Bernier has been on it. Totally wish he could have done that in game 6 of the playoffs last year. But, you know, it's okay. I'm totally not bitter about that still. It was just one of those situations where sometimes you just, as Jake said, sometimes you'd rather be lucky than good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. A pretty, I don't want to say bad loss for Anaheim, but you look at these standings now,
yeah.
The Ducks are only 4 points out of the final wild card spot, and they're 4 points back of the Kings for the third spot in the Pacific. But you look at the lay of the land here a little bit, and the San Jose Sharks with 3 games in hand on the Ducks. So it's a bit of a problem. And then there's this logjam with like basically 3 Central Division teams for that final spot. So the Ducks not really doing themselves any favors today, not a death blow by any means, but this race for a playoff spot is only getting more difficult for the Ducks.
Yeah. And one thing I do want to add on this game tonight is I believe a fair amount of the Ducks were looking good in terms of Corsi 4 percentage and scoring chances for, and they looked really solid on that front. But the top line really wasn't that great tonight, or today, I guess. Getzlaff, Raquelin, Perry, they were all sub 50% in terms of Corsi 4 percentage. They generated chances, I guess, but kind of this highlights a big issue moving forward to me. And even though, yes, I did say that, and I do kind of still stand by it, that this is one of those games where all the other lines were going, they just didn't pot them, and eventually those will go in. But at this point, it kind of just feels like if Getzlaff isn't scoring or producing in any way, the Ducks are really having a hard time scoring goals, and that's not exactly a recipe for success moving forward. And I think that's a really kind of big issue that the team needs to focus on, and it's concerning.
Absolutely. And I mean, you look at, I mean, I tweeted this out during the bye week, but the Ducks record with and without Getzlaff, it's pretty much night and day. And obviously there's some, you know, there's a bunch of variables at play in that, but I would be very interested to see the Ducks record when Getzlaff registers a point versus when he doesn't. One little subplot, I guess, out of today's game that I would take away from these statistics here is that Corey Perry, it just seems like whatever line he plays on this season has a hard time at 5-on-5, whereas Getzlaff and Raquel are typically money together. But you throw Perry on that line, and the stats take a little dip looking at their wowies here. So that's an interesting little tidbit there. But like I said, the playoff race only getting, more interesting for Anaheim. But let's get to the topic du jour, which is, you know, everyone's been talking about it all day here. Caused quite a stir after the Kings game on Saturday. Andrew Cogliano suspended for 2 games by the NHL Department of Players Safety for his hit on Adrian Kempe during the Kings game. Basically, all of the Ducks fan base getting up in arms about it, ending his 830 games played Ironman streak, which is the 4th longest streak in NHL history, which is pretty damn impressive. So let's get right into it. CJ, I'm going to start with you. What are your kind of quick, kind of, I guess, what was your reaction to the suspension when it first happened?
When it first happened, I have to say I was pretty pissed. I think the natural fan
I think you're speaking
instinct,
for a lot of Ducks fans there.
Yeah, exactly, right? I really the Ducks fan in me really kind of took over and was pretty pissed, because upon looking at that hit, you know, I looked at like one or two replays of the hit, and I thought, okay, maybe a fine, but there's no way they suspend him anything like that. And news came out, two games. First, you know, thought, oh my God, Peros, how could you? But you know, after looking at it a little bit more, settling down a little bit, and really kind of coming to understand this and looking at, you know, really what the play was, which was a high hit. There was head contact made. I kind of came to realize that, you know what, I get the frustration. I'm still frustrated to, you know, now at the lack of consistency in the Department of Player Safety. And I'm not entirely confident that that's ever going to go away anytime soon. But, you know, hits to the head, hits in that area need to be taken out of the game. There's absolutely no reason for that. The Ducks have had history of this as well. You know, Silverberg, Kasha, Paul Kariya, all these people, Simone Dupre, who have had careers either ended or missed significant periods of time with head injuries. And so just kind of thinking back to all that, once I settled down a little bit, I became, you know what, it's harsh, but at the end of the day, in a vacuum, I think it may have been the right call.
So Jake, let's get to you here. I know that you have some thoughts as well. So your initial reaction, and I know that both you and CJ wrote about it, and you've kind of been talk about it a lot on Twitter here, but let's get into the nuts and bolts of this a little bit
because
it's not as simple as, oh, it was a bad hit or not. There's some, believe it or not, there's some legislation in place that has been collectively bargained by the Players Association.
Yeah.
So let's get into that little bit.
Yeah. And I think briefly, just kind of my instant reaction was similar to CJ on this completely. And I think regardless of my opinion on the hit or anything like that, I think overall, it's a crummy way for his Iron Man streak to end.
It's very crummy.
100% agreed.
And I think that's where a lot of the frustration in the fan base is coming from, and I think that's warranted. I think it's hard to see, and he had a really great interview today, and we'll probably get to that more in a bit. But it's just it's hard to really get your head around in terms of that this is the way it ends. This isn't the way that I would have ever foreseen the Iron Man streak ending. But kind of transitioning to what Felix was talking about, so we all kind of know the interference call, it's not actually legislated, the 0.7 seconds, but that is the rule of thumbs. Anything over 0.7 seconds after the puck is released is considered interference. And as the video kind of said on that, it was a good second or two after the puck was released. He released the puck right at the basically at center ice. No, he released it at center
you're
ice.
Right. Yeah.
And the hit comes within the neutral or within the offensive zone. So if you're just looking at distance traveled between puck being released and the hit coming, you're talking about the distance from center ice to basically within the offensive zone. And so that's one big part of it. Another part is if we come into Rule 48, which the NHL legislated in when they kind of brought in the Department of Player Safety and kind of started really trying to go against this because of all the hits to the head. Rule 48 reads as, or Rule 48.1 reads that a legal check to the head, a hit resulting in contact with the opponent's head where the head was the main point of contact and such contact to the head was avoidable, is not permitted. In determining whether contact with an opponent's head was avoidable, the circumstances of the hit, including the following, shall be considered. The first point, whether the player attempted to hit squarely through the opponent's body and the head was not picked as a result of poor timing, poor angle of approach, or unnecessary extension of the body upward or outward. Point two, whether the opponent put himself in a vulnerable position by assuming a posture that made head contact on an otherwise full body check unavoidable. And then number three, whether the opponent materially changed the position of his body or head immediately prior or simultaneously with the hit in a way that significantly contributed to the head contact. So that's kind of how the rule is written. I think there's a lot in there. And I think that we could definitely dive in. I mean, if we want to, me personally, the number three about whether they're materially changed the position of his body, I think if you watch that, you can see Adrian Kempe, his head is fairly, he's bent over. a bit, but he's in that position basically the entire way. He does move to the right when he goes into the hit, but it's not as if he changed suddenly and drastically and put his head in that position. And kind of my other point on this is, if we look at that very first point that this rule has, and it's saying whether the head was picked or whether it was due to poor timing, I think that this was due to poor timing. I think a lot of that kind of wiggle room within there gets thrown out simply because of the wording and determining whether contact with the head was avoidable. I think probably the way the league looks at it is because this was interference, this entire hit was avoidable and shouldn't have happened. And I think that's a very big point with this. And
I'll go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say, I think a very big thing that a lot of people, I don't know if they're missing or it's just kind of hard to grasp, is we see this hit probably happens a decent amount. It's not a good hit. It's not something you want to see. But I think what makes this hit suspendable, in my opinion, is it's a compounding effort. It's the fact that it's not only interference, but he does catch the head. It's a lot of things. I think if it's not interference, this is just simply a fine. It's the fact that it's everything adding up together. It's when you add up a bunch of little errors, it makes one big error.
Exactly. And if you read the full extent of that rule, my big kind of point of contention with this being a suspension is just that, you know, with the head is the principal point of contact. You know, I know that that's not, there's a lot more stipulations there where it doesn't necessarily have to be the principal point of contact, but it just seemed to me like the head contact came more as a result of kind of, and I guess the rule speaks to this, is more of a reckless, not really reckless, but sort of a poor choice of timing or whatever the case may be with Andrew Cogliano, which brings me kind of to my big overarching question here is, I'm just trying to figure out, I understand Cogliano, it's a physical game, rivalry game, and he's probably just trying to gain body position and not making it easy on his opponent to enter the zone. But like, it just, I'm really wondering what he thought he was going to accomplish there that wasn't going to result in a penalty or supplemental discipline. And I think it's more bad luck than anything that he caught the guy in the head, but he put himself in a very, very terrible position.
Yeah, and I think kind of before I'm done, I just kind of want to say that I just think it's poor timing. I think there was an intent to injure him. That's, I think, not what any of us are saying. A lot of times, this game is played at a really, really fast speed and breakneck pace. And
well, look at the timing. You mentioned the rule of thumb, 0.7 seconds. Yeah. That's the rule of thumb. That's not a lot of time.
Yeah. And so we're talking split-second decision-making, and a lot of times what takes a hit from being clean to dirty is just a slight error in miscalculation, or a slight error in your calculation of your approach angle, of anything like that, of not realizing where the guy is correctly, or anything like that. And that's just what happened here. It was just a mistimed hit, and it's crummy that it results in a suspension, but I think at the end of the day, you got to protect the players, and I think that's at the end of the day what this was doing.
Yeah, CJ, let's get some of your thoughts in here. I mean, now we're getting, let's get more into the big picture of this.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot of, we've kind of broken down the nuts and bolts here. I guess my final thought here would just be that I think the principal point of contact as the head, I don't think that's what really gets Cogliano here. It's more what we've been talking about, which is the avoidability. And also the fact that Kempe, because there's a stipulation within the rule where did the opponent put himself in a vulnerable position? And Kempe has a right to his ice in that situation. And you can't just assault a guy, basically. But let's kind of zoom out here. You know, obviously, I don't believe, and I've heard the guys from the Department of Player Safety in multiple interviews, and they will always say that they have a very strict rule book or a strict way of doing this, and that, you know, this is collectively bargained, blah blah blah, legal jargon. But I really think that there are politics at play. I just think that's the nature of the beast. What do you think, not just politics wise, but do you think there's kind of a larger maybe theme at play here that we're missing out on?
You know, I want to say yes, because given the fact that this is Andrew Cogliano with no prior history, had a huge streak going, everything like that, that definitely makes this suspension more newsworthy. It's outraged more people, obviously. I don't think there's any sort of political thing necessarily against going after the Ducks themselves. I've seen that be insinuated by a few fans that the Department of Player Safety is out to get the Ducks based on, you know, the fact that the Ducks are the most penalized team in the league and nobody likes us, blah, 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 blah.
No one likes us.
No one likes us. We don't care.
God, I hate that.
I kind of like it. Shut up.
I enjoy it.
But
you're a rule tier.
There you go.
There you go.
I'm going to disagree with that. Really, to me, what if there is any sort of politics here, it's that they're using this player, this well-loved player with a chasing a milestone as an example to signal their that no one is above the rule, and that we are going to start coming down hard on these. Now, obviously, as I mentioned before, the Department of Player Safety has been horribly inconsistent over the last few years. And this suspension really is no exception to that rule. So I would be a little bit more, I don't want to use the term happy, but I would be more understanding and be more willing to give player safety, you know, the benefit of the doubt if this indeed signal a new era in cracking down on headshots, on harshly punishing headshots. For that matter, not just a fine or a game ban, like truly telling them there is no place for this in the modern game. I'm not entirely sure, the NHL Department of Player Safety has not given, in my opinion, any reason for me to give them the benefit of the doubt on that, especially given the fact that there were, you know, some similar plays, you know, with hits to the head for a couple of the other Kings players during that game. There's, you know, things like the Giordano hit, which some people argue in his game the other day that people think should have been suspended. There's a few things in there. So really only time will tell kind of going from here on out. But if there is any bigger political thing, I at least hope it would be to use him as an example that they're going to crack down from here on out. I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but we're going to have to see. And that's kind of the only logical reasoning that I can think of based on that.
Well, so a couple things here. First off, look, they're not inconsistent. They're consistently inconsistent. So they are consistent.
but that's something.
My biggest thing though, with these situations, anytime there's a quote unquote controversial suspension, is that we as observers tend to look at it more from a common sense perspective. You know, it's like, was this play suspendable or not? But as Jake kind of outlined just now, you know, looking through this rule, the people that are in charge of this are, they're wading through essentially legal waters.
So messy.
This is very true.
This is an agreement between the union, the employees, and the employers. And it's been collectively bargained. It's a huge sticking point. And so they have a lot more things to consider than the average observer when looking at these plays. They literally have to, you know, comb through every stipulation within the rules. They have to consider every angle. And that's why you get these decisions that on the outside may not seem like common sense, but within their very tight legal framework is, I guess, compliant. Now, do I agree with this sort of thinking? Well, on one hand, yes, it's the rules that they've agreed upon. So this is the outcome you get. But on the other hand, I think that common sense has to win the day sometimes. And I'm not saying in every particular case, but I think there has to be a bit more application there. And if I look at this play with Andrew Cogliano, first off, a very poor decision by him to go in for a hit on a defenseless player. He's actually lucky that it didn't result in a worse outcome. I mean, he even mentioned in his little interview that I'm sure we'll get to that he didn't injure the player. I'm not sure that's not something you want to use in your defense, although I understand that that is something that gets used when making the decisions, where did the play result in an injury, which to me is kind of the wrong way to look at it. It's more about the intent.
Absolutely. Yep.
And he's lucky that he didn't hurt the guy, because Kempe was not looking at all, had no time to brace himself, and he could have really hurt him. So terrible decision by him. And the play was penalized. Clearly interference. That's what interference is. But on the other hand, I mean, look, it's there have been so much. It's like you kind of alluded to, CJ. There's been so many plays that we have deemed from a common sense perspective to be much worse that have not been suspended. Look no further than Nick Ritchie. I believe it was on Kevin Fiala against the Nashville Predators a few months back. Exactly. Where he clobbers him in the head, you literally see his head bend the wrong way after a goal. And I think, yeah, that resulted in a penalty, but nothing more. And you ask yourself,
I'm pretty sure he was suspended one game.
No, not for that one.
Nope. Was he not?
He was suspended
be thinking back.
He was suspended last season for a sucker punch with the fist to Michael Roosevelt on the Blackhawks.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Which is insane if you think about the fact that with that prior history that he was not suspended further or that he wasn't suspended for that last play. So when you see stuff like that, which to me isn't even close to hockey, that's basically assault. If that happened out in the street, that would be considered assault, and you can potentially face jail time for that. In hockey, that's just a hockey play. He's just angry, whatever. He's a hockey player. So that doesn't get suspended. But this play where, poor choice by Cogliano, but ultimately, like I said, doesn't hurt the guy, kind of accidentally makes contact with the head. I think the initial point of contact was more of the chest. So I look at this, and I'm like, well, you're going to suspend this guy for two games where he has the cleanest of sheets, and a guy like Nick Ritchie who mugs a guy gets nothing. You know, well,
what I don't understand. You have in the same game Tanner Pearson clearly on camera elbowing Adam Henrique, and you have things like that. That the intent's clearly there to catch him with an elbow in the face, and it's just it. To me, it feels like there's a clear statement from the NHL that they're trying to protect players within the run of play from getting caught in the head, and no players
which is great,
and I think that we all agree on that. I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head, though, that they need to refocus and look at these other issues that they kind of consider to be, I don't know if good hockey plays is what they consider it, but it's just like, oh, that's how the game should be played and all that stuff. And
it's the intensity.
it's injurious by nature. And if we're talking about player safety here, which we are, and I think that's kind of the big overarching kind of buzzword that should be kind of going with this discussion is, we're talking about protecting players from getting hurt and not having to deal with CTE, not having to deal with concussions, not having to deal with that, and being able to play the game at a high level and kind of play the game. And these issues all kind of do the same thing, and they're not safe for the players. And having a guy elbowing someone in the head is just as bad as Cogliano's hit. And I think that's a big frustration in that type of stuff.
Absolutely. And I'd like to point out here really quick as well, though, that as JC argued in his article yesterday, that to me, you can easily separate these two issues out. Yes, they are related and they can form one another, but arguing whether or not in a vacuum,
yes,
Cogliano should have been suspended for the hit, and also calling out the Department of Player Safety to look at different ones and comparing it to it, those can be two separate arguments yet related. There's a lot of people who I think think that they are mutually exclusive, when I necessarily think they don't have to be. So these are all great points that we definitely need to talk about, and we have, and really look at it here. But it's important to remember that there is a distinction that they are two separate issues, albeit related to one another.
Right. And Literate Gal here brings up in the Mixler chat, what can be done, though, gentlemen, if today's catalog of voices is coming out against this ruling, then can/should it be reversed or at least addressed formally by the council? Now, my quick answer here, and then I'll throw it to you guys, is that I honestly believe that the Department of Player Safety, I believe that, like I kind of alluded to this earlier, but their hands are basically tied. You know, they are operating within a very strict legal framework that they didn't really have any say over. And so, or at least they weren't the sole people that came up with these rules. And so I don't know how much they can actually do right now. We're literally going to have to wait until the next lockout or the next, I shouldn't say the next lockout, but it's kind of the same thing. The next time the CBA runs out.
You know what's not when that's your default terminology.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. You're like, that's pretty bad. That was my go-to. But I think this is one of those things where what we can do, what the NHL, what the players should do, the next time that they are sitting down to negotiate the CBA is to really take a look at all types of, you know, what they call like sub-concussive hits to the head. Not the hits that are clearly going to knock a guy out or clearly could really hurt a guy, but the stuff like you just talked about here, like the elbow, just a slight elbow to the face, the Nick Ritchie mugging on Kevin Fiala, stuff like that. I feel like that stuff doesn't get looked at enough, and it's because of this tight framework that they've established that, quite frankly, doesn't really jibe with common sense and player safety.
Yeah, and kind of I want to just hit on kind of two points really quickly, if that's all good with both of you. I know we've been bashing player safety, and I think rightfully so, and I think that that's kind of the best thing we can do at this moment is kind of make our voices heard, whether it's on this podcast, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on kind of social media. All we can do is kind of make it known that not, to me, you shouldn't be railing against them for suspending Cogliano, but you should be kind of holding them, holding firm that they should be looking at these other plays. But I do think that I at least personally feel like we need to give them some credit. There's been a lot of progress, and I think
of course.
And I think if we look 5-10 years back, those headshots and those types of plays, those were constantly in the game. And it's worked its way out, and it's been because of the Department of Player Safety being established. It's been because not only have they been suspending guys and kind of putting those guys who are constantly delivering these hits, they're suspending them for a good amount of time, like Rafi Torres, but they're also doing a really good job of educating the players on what is and what isn't a good hit, and how you should follow through on a guy, and what you can and can't do. And that's just what I've kind of heard throughout the league and heard on different podcasts and different mediums, that they're doing a really good job of educating the players. And so even though, yes, there are gripes, and yes, there's more that they can do to protect players, I think that we do need to give them some credit that they've come a long way, and the game has come a long way along with that. And I think that, yes, there's always more progress that can be done, and yes, we should always want more progress, but I think at the same time we need to respect that it's been good. It's been a good movement forward. And kind of the other point is kind of in response to Literate Gal about what can be done in terms of the suspension. And I just kind of wanted to lay it out there. And this is from the NHL player safety and kind of from their frequently asked questions about appealing the decision. And just wanted to kind of put this out there for everyone listening, that if a suspension is 6 games or less, a player can appeal it, but it can only go to Bettman. And to me, Bettman's not going to go against
the league. It's not worth it.
No, it's not
going to. It's two games. Yeah.
And so it's only if the suspension is 6 games or more are the players allowed to take it to Bettman and then take it to a neutral arbitrator after that. And that's kind of the big thing with a lot of times you'll hear in-person or over-the-phone hearing. When it's an in-person hearing, the league is allowed to give the players more than 5 games. If it's an over-the-phone hearing, they're only allowed to give them 5 games max. And I think a lot of that has to do with the appeals process.
CJ, you got anything to add there?
No, I think you summed it up pretty damn well.
Yeah.
Well, I want to add another thing here, because so this is another aspect of this, of the fallout of the decision that I think I want to touch on a little bit, is you see there were a lot of people within the game that came out, notably like Francois Beauchemin, I think Ty Domi.
Jeremy Roenick.
Tweeted some, Jeremy Roenick, you know, kind of the old school guy saying like, what the hell, you know, this isn't a suspension by any means. And I do think that on the spectrum of suspensions, this is easily one of the softer ones. Like, yep. I don't think that that's arguable. Sure.
I think that's agreeable.
And honestly, I was surprised when I saw that he got 2 games. And I didn't feel really strongly either way. And like, if it hadn't been suspended, I don't think I would have really been that bothered.
Yeah.
But really though, when you look at this, I think what really gets, and I've already kind of said this, but what really kind of kills Cogliano here is the fact that he basically went after it. I mean, like he didn't have to do that in that situation. Like it's not as if they were already close to each other and he's just rubbing him out for space. He basically went after him. And like, that visual is pretty powerful. And if the league had basically said, you know what, when you get rid of the puck at the blue line or at center ice and you keep skating, it's your job to keep your head up. And, you know, if a guy like Andrew Cogliano hits you right in the chest, then maybe the chin, that's on you. Like, I think that they had to take a stand here. And I think ultimately it is the correct decision by the letter of the law. Big picture wise, you know, a lot of people talk about the streak and this is such a crappy way to end the streak. But really, if Andrew Cogliano, his streak ends at 874, 830, like, who actually cares, right? Or am I alone on this island?
You're a bit alone there. I want to see you keep going.
Well, but look at it this way, though. I mean, my biggest thing is that everyone talks about the streak and how dare they end his streak. But first off, it's not the NHL's fault that Andrew Cogliano has, you know, played all these games. And secondly, what are they supposed to do? Like, oh, congratulations, pat on the back. You played all these games. We're going to let you off scot-free.
Oh,
you know,
sorry.
Like, that's my big kind of, like, because people really brought that up as kind of like a sticking point. And to me, in any fair society or any fair system, you can't, like, I don't think that, do you think, okay, I guess this leads to my question. Do you think that the streak ought to be a point of consideration when handing out or stipulating on this decision?
Absolutely, 100% not.
Okay, no. So that's CJ's take. Tell us why.
Because to me, that gives certain players an advantage. That gives certain players, really just a situation where you're not treating the same plays fairly. You know, if a guy here with no prior history but is going for, you know, the all-time 964 game record there, commits this hit, and the same guy with completely clean history does the same exact hit, but maybe, you know, is a rookie or something like that, and in his first season, you're really gonna give the guy with more of the games, you're really gonna give him a break over that, only in the name of really chasing the record and glory and name in the hall, whatever that happens to be. When you're talking about safety here and you're talking about protecting your players, it does not matter what your past accomplishments are. You need to view all these actions as the same.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly think that, you know, I mean, I myself, in just kind of like as a side job, I referee soccer. I've refereed soccer for a long, long time. And, you know, when I'm refereeing, do I consider the type of player that a guy is when I'm calling a foul? Of course, it plays a factor. You know, it plays a role in your decision, but ultimately the rules are the rules. And I think with Cogliano, what you can say is that the NHL did consider sort of his profile. I mean, the fact that he had no prior history, that played a role. He could have gotten more games suspended if it hadn't been for his clean sheet. And, you know, I do think that on some level, on some maybe marginal level, the fact that he's been this exemplary guy, that he has a streak, I think that when you are deciding on this punishment, especially in this specific instance where it was not the most malicious of plays, I think that that should play a very small role in your decision. Yeah. I'm not saying that's going to make your decision, but I think you should at least consider it. Now, if it were a case where he clearly just blindsided the hell out of a guy and injured someone, well, then everything gets thrown out the window. But in this case, clearly there was some leniency handed out, but I think it has to play somewhat of a role because, you know, in a court of law, when, you know, a judge is stipulating, everything gets considered, right? And I feel like this is kind of a similar situation.
Yeah. We got a couple things in the Mixler just kind of on that note, so this is a good transition. Just kind of shout out the people in the Mixler chat. Thank you to the four people in there. At the GC Ducks fan brings up tonight on NBC Sports during the Islanders Habs game, Jeremy Roenick stated that he didn't agree with Cog's suspension and at worst should have received a fine. He then described Cogs as a stand-up guy who's disciplined before stating that sometimes you gotta turn a blind eye.
What?
While I agree with him regarding Cogliano receiving no more than a fine, I have to completely disagree with his view on turning a blind eye to players like Cogs because they're good guys. A remark which I find to be absolutely irresponsible. What I and so many other fans want is consistency in the league's disciplinary action. Turning a blind eye to certain players is the complete opposite in being just that.
Well, and exactly. That makes it worse. And, you know, yeah, sure, he's a good guy. He's a great guy until he's not anymore, until he's done something wrong. Then you have to consider it. Well, and the next time Andrew Cogliano does something, this is going to come, this is going to be considered as well. So,
well,
and, I don't know. And the problem real quick here with Jeremy Roenick's take is that he also is viewing it like, you know, 99% of people, where he's just, and it's fine. He's entitled to his opinion like anyone else, but he's doling out the kind of common sense angle. But you have to consider the fact that these guys making these decisions are extremely bound by the rules that they've been dealt. So I don't know, but it's classic JR. I mean, I wouldn't really expect much from him anyway.
Yeah. And then Literate Gal also brought up, it's a point of character in the man, not the number of games played. I think that was just in reference to us talking about the games. My brief opinion kind of on this, I feel like we've beaten that a bit to death, but I just think that prior history is considered. It's written in the NHL rulebook for suspensions that prior history should be considered, regardless of whether they're considered a repeat offender or not. Repeat offender actually only matters for how the player gets paid. If they are considered a repeat offender, I believe it basically changes the scale on what they on the amount of money they lose. Whereas if they're not a repeat offender, they lose less money. But even if they're not a repeat offender, their prior history can, and it's past the however timeline they have for them being considered a repeat offender, their prior history can come into play in terms of determining suspensions. I personally just think you can't take into consideration someone's prior history. I think what George brings up, that turning a blind eye, that does kind of the exact wrong thing. Every player should be held accountable to the same set of rules.
But you don't think any prior stuff matters, or are you saying
I think some of it does.
I don't really think so. I mean, this is just me kind of, and this is me spitballing as we're going, and maybe my opinion is going to change as you guys talk. But I just think you got to look at each play on an individual level. And I think if a play is dangerous, it's dangerous. And a guy needs, if it's suspension worthy, it's suspension worthy. We need to kind of address it as it goes. And the only time that we should really consider prior history is after we've looked at the play. And that's, I think, how the NHL Department of Player Safety is supposed to, quote unquote, look at it, is that they look at the plays and then prior history only comes into play about determining the number of games. If they've determined it's a suspension, and let's just say, for instance, Andrew Cogliano was a repeat offender, wasn't the stand-up guy that we all talk about, and had a bunch of suspensions in the past year or two. They've determined it's a suspension. Instead of being two games, they will now look, he has a prior history of doing this, we need to suspend him for more. It inflates to maybe 10 games. Who knows? That's the way that it theoretically kind of should happen, in my opinion.
Yes, but exactly. That's the key word, theoretically. I have a hard time believing that these people in charge of making these decisions robotically compile all of the rules and then say this is the decision. I think that that's the crux of it. That's like 90% of it, but I do think there is a 10% in there.
So that settles it. We need to make sure that we make a player safety bot that runs on artificial intelligence. And, Silicon Valley's doing this stuff. It's easy. Let's get on it.
I mean, do we want to go back to what was it in back when Brendan Shanahan, they had
the wheel of discipline.
Yes. There we go.
I mean, the way, what I'm really getting here is that CJ and I are the living, breathing Constitution crowd. And Jake is the textualism, you know, Justice Scalia type here.
I mean, I am an engineer, you know, where the code's the code.
Yep. No, but I tend to fall more on that side in most cases. But I just think that in this specific case, it's very much on the extreme with Cogliano, you know, where we really do know what this guy is about. And look, at the end of the day, it actually helped him, right? Like, we're acting as if, or I guess I'm acting as if none of this mattered, but the fact that he had no prior record, and I think that that little 10% I'm speaking to, I think it probably did help him out and probably got him less games. So anyway, we got any more on this? We got one more topic to cover here.
We got just kind of giving a couple shout outs in the Mixler chat. Literate Gal brought up, there was some mockery online about Andrew's tears. If you feel that it's a worthy topic, why do we keep coming back to no crying in
sport? No crying in baseball.
No crying in baseball. Cogliano showed character, not weakness, and being emotional. I think she just kind of really hits it on the head that, to me, doesn't matter. I mean, I don't care. I don't think of him as less of a man or anything like that. I think that that conversation to me, regardless of that interview, and I really highly suggest everyone go and watch it. I think regardless of your opinion on the hit, whether you liked it, whether or like the suspension, whether you don't think there should be a suspension, I think that just really kind of shows the character of Andrew Cogliano and the type of person that he would kind of step out and really answer questions. Because not a lot of guys, I feel, would... not a lot of guys like to kind of fess up and answer for something. And he was really honest. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for that.
He always has been. That's the thing I've always loved about Cogliano and why he's been deserving of, you know, that A when people are down or injured. He's one of those guys who really doesn't mince words and can answer the bell.
Yep,
absolutely. And I mean, just to kind of continue here, I think that I was impressed as well by his composure, talking to Kent French, who, by the way, did a good job in kind of steering along that interview while not
good job, Frenchie.
Kind of. Yeah, and I think that I wonder actually if Cogliano asked to be interviewed. I would actually be curious about that because I feel like it might have been his idea.
Wouldn't shock me.
Yeah, because I don't know. But also, you know, I think that the fact that he, like you guys said, stepped up to the mic, kind of said, you know, he gave his side of the story. I think that he did a good job of sort of accounting for everything, every angle of the situation. But this is a guy who just, you don't play 830 games in a row. I mean, there's obviously a lot of luck involved, but I think it really speaks, and you watch him play, it really speaks just how dedicated this guy is to the game of hockey. I think he's a consummate professional. I think the way he carries himself, he's a no-excuses kind of guy. And, like, I really haven't really seen him play many bad games in the games that I've watched him. So, anyway, like, I don't think any less of Andrew Cogliano after this situation. I think he probably got a little caught in the heat of the moment in what was a very fiery game. And, you know, I think he may learn from it, may not. I don't think he really has to change much. All right.
I think that's what you kind of hope. That's what you kind of hope with player safety is it's an ongoing education.
Exactly. Yeah. And he knows now, and he probably already knew, is that you can't hit a guy when he's not looking at all towards you and is completely away from the play. But anyway, that's why he got suspended.
Yep.
So I'm going to let the some of the air get out of the room here for a little bit. And I guess to kind of spin this forward a little bit, you know, there was a lot of consternation on Twitter about, you know, the way Anaheim Calling handled this and the way it was covered. And look, all I will say, because I don't think I really tweeted about it that much, nor did I write anything, but we're not really beholden to the court of popular opinion. And, you know, if people don't like what we say, you know, we're not here to please the crowd. And I think that at the end of the day, as long as we're fair about the way we cover it, that's kind of all that needs to be done. So that's all I have to say on that.
One thing.
Oh, absolutely. I'm the guy who's been running the Twitter account, you know, for most of today and last night. So I got a good look into some of the stuff people were saying at us, some of the names people were calling us. You know, at the end of the day, you know, we kind of expected some blowback, and it's the internet, so you have to assume you're going to get some pretty bad stuff when you're coming up with opinions that go against what's popular at the time, at least regionally. So Little Gal says, throw that catfish on the ice, boys. There we go.
I do like fried catfish, though. It's pretty good.
So that's just one of those things that, like, I appreciate. I just want to say, as the guy who runs the Twitter account, I sincerely appreciate all the fans who either expressed agreement at our opinion or disagreement, respectful disagreement, and stated their case why, and were able to have a good, productive, you know, kind of debate and conversation about why we thought the way we did. And, you know, all opinions, you know, definitely are considered and acknowledged. You know, we're not claiming to have the complete 100% right opinion. But I do want to say I do appreciate those people who were respectfully, you know, disagreeing.
Yep. And I kind of second that. And then just for me, I had really good conversations today on Twitter, and my DMs are always open. My Twitter account, I'm always open to reply to people. If you disagree with anything I write or anything I said on here, feel free to throw me a tweet. As long as you're respectful and just kind of open to a good conversation, I'm always open for that. No question to me is a dumb question as long as you're respectful. I've had plenty of great conversations with people that listen to the pod that just have questions about the game. And so if you have questions about this or want or disagree with what I say and want to kind of come at me at it, do it. And I'm completely fine with that. Just be respectful. I think that be kind to everyone. That's my two cents on this.
Well, I don't know how much I can add there because I feel like I probably – it's easy. You guys have it easy because you're Ducks fans, so generally people agree with you. I just – like, it doesn't matter what I tweet. I'm going to get something back.
Those are my favorites.
I mean, yeah. You don't have
people
to say
you – just crap on you. Oh, my God.
You don't have to say Miller Lite.
The new thing that I'm experiencing is someone will say something in disagreement and or reply to a tweet in disagreement, and instead of me getting a bunch of replies disagreeing – that tweet will get like 100 likes or something, you know, not actually 100, but people. And like, it's like, all right, guys, like, thanks, you know.
Felix, but, I'm sorry for all the Miller Lite sucks tweets then.
Oh,
I'm not.
I don't care what people say about that. I'm going to keep drinking my Miller Lite. More for me.
You know what? I can respect that. You do you. Stick to your guns, Felix.
Yeah, oh. I mean, I don't give a, yeah.
Oh, my choice of beer still sucks, but you do you.
Okay, so let's get to the next topic, which I feel much more strongly about.
You got opinions.
So here we go.
Hot takes.
Sunday, I believe Sunday morning, it was announced that the Ducks were going to be placing Logan Shaw on waivers to then subsequently claim JT Brown from the Tampa Bay Lightning. JT Brown, who I believe has 19 goals in 286 NHL games.
Elite.
Let me start this off by saying that I don't think that Logan Shaw is a world beater by any means, but I do think that he had kind of established a little niche for himself this season. You know, like most of the Ducks forwards, his shot rates are pretty bad, but he's had some good numbers in different combinations. And I really just think that he's a guy who, at least from a visual standpoint, I could tell had worked on his game. He's gotten a little bit more mobile. I think his hands have improved a little bit. And it was just very odd for me to see a guy like that who has just been perfectly fine. I mean, has been your run-of-the-mill fourth liner for the Ducks this season, who typically those guys are the ones who get the most love on this team. To see a guy like that just kind of get kicked aside really makes me wonder, actually, if there was something more that we're just not privy to. Because JT Brown, I don't think is an upgrade at all. I'm not sure if he's a downgrade, but it's just one of those bizarre lateral moves. And I don't know. I mean, knowing Bob Murray's track record, maybe he didn't expect Logan Shaw to get claimed off of waivers. But as it was announced this morning, Logan Shaw will now be a member of the Montreal Canadiens, claimed off of waivers. Him being from Nova Scotia, he'll be a lot closer to home than over here in Orange County. But I don't know. It's just kind of weird. A guy who's been serviceable to just kind of kick him to the curb and basically have him pick up his life and move on. It's for like another fourth liner who's, to my eye, not discernibly any better. It's just a little odd. I guess that's my big takeaway, is that it was weird. So who wants to disagree with me first?
I'll jump in first. Let's go. I'm ready for a fight, even though I really don't have that strong of opinions on this. So kind of going into it, I think probably I thought Logan Shaw would clear waivers. Let me know if I'm wrong on this, Felix, but I think I saw that Andrew Shaw was injured and put on IR today.
Yes,
and so that opened up a roster spot. So it may have just kind of been bad timing, as much as it sounds.
Right. Yeah.
With Montreal having an open roster spot, and
well, they just wanted all the Shaws. That's what it was.
Yeah, exactly. They now have to throw an A on that Shaw jersey and an L on the Shaw jersey.
Oh my goodness! I don't want to. Actually, no. The Canadians don't do that.
Oh, they
when
don't.
When the Kostitsyns,
but
both
they're brothers.
Were on the Niedermeyers didn't either. I don't know. Anyway, continue.
So, getting back to the kind of the original point is. Yeah, I think it's hard to really argue. I think JT Brown, maybe he's a little bit more versatile. From what I heard Carlisle's comments on him yesterday, and I think they liked what they saw from him in Tampa. They saw that he was playing up, it was either on the first or second line at one point that they were there, and then on another point he was on the fourth line, and I'm pretty sure he scored a goal against the Ducks this season also.
Oh, so that must have been it. That may have factored in.
Bob saw that goal and was like, I need him.
Yeah, so that may have factored in. I think it's a marginal upgrade. I think if you look at stats, he's better. I think you brought up this point that it could be the system and that type of point. But yeah. I think the bigger issue at hand here, and I think the real upgrade with him, is he's coming into the lineup over Jared Bull. And I think that the Ducks didn't exactly want to play Shaw over Bull, and that was clear with the Kings game. That's been clear in a couple different situations where JT Brown comes in and Carlisle immediately says he's going to the lineup. We didn't bring him in here to sit in the press box. And so that, to me, kind of is a sign that he's going to be in the lineup. They're not going to, and I don't think they're going to scratch Wagner for Bull. I don't see that happening with how much they love him. No, so I think, yes, they lose Shaw, and so it's easy to identify it as Shaw for Brown. But I think in the bigger picture, it's more so Shaw or Brown coming into the lineup and Bull coming out. I think the really head-scratching thing here, and I think CJ and I both agree on this point, is that Jared Bull, because he was put on waivers and cleared waivers and only recently came up and has only been on the roster for a couple of days, only played in one game, he can be sent down without requiring waivers again. And
exactly. So,
so why
was Logan Shaw the one that had to bite the bullet here?
Yes.
That is completely insane.
Yeah. And so I think that if we want to harp on an issue and really be critical, I think that's the point. I don't think the point is that JT Brown is a marginal upgrade or is bad or anything. I think the big issue is the fact that why in the heck did they put Logan Shaw on waivers? And granted, Logan Shaw, replacement player, I think he's a dime a dozen. It's really neutral. It's really not a huge deal in the grand scheme of things. It's just more an overall mindset of the organization that they'd rather lose this guy who is fairly versatile in Shaw.
Who's useful. In a very confined sense,
yes,
but still useful. Yeah.
And like I said, he is a replacement-level player. Jared Bull is below a replacement-level player.
You don't say.
And, say the least.
And so, and granted, he had a good game, I think, against the Kings.
Oh,
he,
don't even go there.
A good game for Bull.
I'm all for fairness, but come on, Jay. Come on.
Fine.
So, if you're okay, I want to point out something.
Yes, CJ, let's get your thoughts on this.
I want to point out that one of my first thoughts was the fact that San Diego now with the Ducks finally getting healthy and sending some players back, San Diego finally has their team here. Before the season started, San Diego was expected to be an absolutely stacked team. The Ducks sapped a lot of their depth, and now they're kind of back here. They've been going on a roll and playing really well lately. To me, Bob took a look and said, okay, I got JT Brown here who can, in his mind, adequately replace what Logan Shaw was giving us, and send Logan Shaw down to try and sneak him through waivers and send him down to San Diego, where, quite honestly, I feel like Logan Shaw could probably dominate down in the AHL if he really put it together there. So in my opinion, this was maybe sort of a move of stacking up the goals here and allowing them to go on a run, and then being able to recall Shaw as needed. But that being said, I know one of our staff writers, our big prospect guru John Broadbent, mentioned that the San Diego is so stacked now that it's taking away from some prospects' playing time. I think though that the only thing with that argument is that that's a very good point, but there's still prospects, guys who haven't gotten NHL ability yet. They're still developing in somewhat of unknown commodities where we know exactly what Logan Shaw is and likely have a good idea of what he's going to be able to bring if he goes down to San Diego. So in my mind, I think that I obviously don't know, and I don't claim to know for sure what was going through Murray's mind, but to me, that could definitely be a logical possibility of what he was trying to do.
Right, but we've seen this before with Bob Murray, where he gets caught slipping on these on these waivers. I mean, you remember Chris Wagner a couple seasons ago, where Chris Wagner, who's kind of in the same situation, not really a world beater, but playing just fine, they try to sneak him through waivers, and he gets claimed by the Colorado Avalanche, and I think, I'm trying to remember now how they got him back.
Waivers.
Was it through waivers?
It was through waivers,
yeah, we reclaimed
these things happen, they tend to happen under Bob Murray's watch, and maybe down the line Logan Shaw returns. It's just one of those things where you're causing, in my mind, a lot of undue kind of stress on the guy, where in what seems to be a pretty clearly avoidable situation. So I don't know. I mean, it's just like, at the end of the day, in the grand scheme of things, it's kind of nothing. It's a big nothing burger.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just think there's a human element to this. And like, for a guy like Logan Shaw, who's looked to, establish himself in the NHL, who's, in my mind, played reasonably well this season, to kind of get told to pack up his bags basically because of a clerical error, that must kind of suck. I don't know.
Well, I think, yeah. I think that happens to the NHL. Here's a bit of a hot take on this. And CJ, I thought you were going to go there with this, and you went the opposite direction completely.
Uh-oh, what was that?
What if he was put on waivers and the Ducks wanted him to be claimed to clear money and a roster spot off the team, and the Ducks are comfortable enough with the guys down in the AHL to come up? They still have Dennis Rasmussen down there. They still have
entirely possible.
They still have Kevin Waugh. They still have Kalle Kosola. They still have these guys down there that they may see as serviceable. So maybe they put them on waivers with the hope that someone may claim them. And it's just, I don't know, just kind of something I threw out there. That's a bit of a hot take.
That's possible, but it would only be to clear a roster spot and nothing else, because now the Ducks are actually paying about $200,000 more to have JT Brown on the roster than Logan Shaw.
Yeah,
there's definitely no cap savings there.
I'm talking about real money, though.
I think it's plausible, but again, if you're going to do that, why even get JT Brown? Well, what was the point in that if you're trying to clear a roster?
I mean, that question applies to pretty much any situation involving JT Brown. But
That's a fair point. I think maybe they like JT Brown more than Logan Shaw, and with acquiring JT Brown, they are comfortable with losing him and want to clear actual money, because we talk about cap space and all this stuff, but maybe the Ducks still are worrying about actual money, and so with Logan Shaw going on waivers and going to a different team, there's his money off the books. And one thing is, a lot of times I kind of overlook this, and I think a lot of people do, there is a contract limit in the NHL. You can only have 50 contracts. Mm-hmm. And so the Ducks, if Logan Shaw would have cleared waivers, would have been at 48 contracts. So they were kind of close up to that limit. So maybe, I don't know, just in thought, I figured I'd throw
out
there.
There is an accounting side to this that we don't really consider, which is good that you bring that up. By the way, Michael Scarbosa, 27 points in 39 games this season in the AHL. So I don't know if that really rings a bell to anyone. But Logan Shaw initially acquired by trading Scarbosa to Florida. And I don't know. I like Scarbosa's game. It's kind of interesting that he hasn't cracked the NHL yet, age 25. Not the biggest guy, but I think he's got some skills. So anyway, just throwing that out there.
We all good, because I have something very important to say right now.
Go. I mean, we're talking about Michael Scarbosa. So
I'm very disappointed in George at the GC Ducks fan for not staying by his bit and not showering during the bye week. He told us he wasn't going to shower, and he did.
Come on, man.
He said, I came here to tell you that my no-shower vow lasted a day. I'm sorry I worked with public, and stinkiness started to take its toll. Should have thought twice. Missed you, though. Well, thank you for coming back, and thank you for missing us. But I don't know how I'm ever going to forgive you.
I mean, thank you for sparing the public. I think that this is about the people.
No,
we're all about the people on this show.
I'm all about the bits.
Speak for yourself.
Your Colorado Avalanche.
Jake, if you haven't seen already, George did just point out that Kevin Waugh just scored for the goal. So Kevin Waugh fan club, sound off. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, why isn't he in the NHL? JT Brown is. So anyway. All right. Guys, I think it's been a really good show today. Hit on a lot of good topics. Good to be back.
Yeah,
kind of felt weird. Like I got this weird twitch today. Like, hadn't pottered in a while, and the Ducks were on. So I'm glad that we're back. I'm glad that we had CJ on, and three guys here to kind of break down what was a bit of a heavy topic here with the suspension. So I'm glad we hit on that. Any final notes before we get out of here?
Nope. Just want to say sorry that I didn't get my weekly rankings up, rating things during to do during the bye week. I was pretty sick and dealing with some stuff over the bye week.
Yeah, Jake, I was waiting to put you on blast live on the podcast here instead of just dropping into the Slack chat. I wanted to humiliate you in public.
Yeah, I've been sick over the past week, so sorry about that, guys.
Everyone send Jake their well wishes. And if you really want to make him feel better, you can leave a review on iTunes and leave a rating. That will make him feel one hell of a whole lot better.
When antibiotic resistance finally takes hold, all the don't bring that up. with iTunes and podcast reviews.
I don't want to think about that. Okay, so on that depressing note of antibiotic resistance, we are going to get out of here. We have a busy week ahead. The Ducks have three more games this week. Wednesday against the Penguins, Sidney Crosby and company come to town to Honda Center. Ducks play the Kings again Friday night at Honda Center, and then Sunday night against the San Jose Sharks. So a lot of good games this week, all at home. So a pretty big week for the Ducks in terms of maybe climbing up the standings here. We're going to have it all covered. We are going to be, I guess we're going to have three podcasts coming out. So look for those after every game. We're back in the saddle here, winding down the second half of the season. It's crazy. We're already, 45 games into the Ducks season? Mm-hmm. So things are winding down here, and the trade deadline is coming up. So a lot of good stuff coming your way from AnaheimCalling.com. That'll do it for today. Like we mentioned here, if you've been enjoying the show, please, please, please leave a review and a rating on iTunes. We've been climbing up the charts slowly but surely, and we would appreciate your continued support. SoundCloud.com/ACPod. If you're on SoundCloud, give us a follow there. And as always, AnaheimCalling.com, at AnaheimCalling on Twitter for all your Ducks content needs. CJ is on Twitter at CJ Woodling, also running the Anaheim Calling Twitter account. So direct all your hatred towards him. Calling tweets something I don't agree with. Just kidding. Although that will happen anyway. Jake is on Twitter at ReindeerGames91, tweeting out his weekly rankings as well as the podcast. I'm on Twitter at Felix_Sicard. And that will do it for today, guys. We will catch you Wednesday night after the Penguins game. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Later.